So you might, some people ask me what I'm doing speaking in the Institute for Theoretical Physics, but Boris and I are involved in a collaboration with Ken Kosick, tracing the evolutionary origins of synapses. And so Boris invited me here for this biology seminar, and happy to have an audience. So I think one of the most profound generalities in the last 20 or 30 years in biology, and especially evolutionary biology, is this highly conserved molecular machinery, even across major animal groups such as phyla, which we wouldn't necessarily have expected. And these are just some examples of that. The Ingrail gene, for example, is involved in body patterning across different phyla. The PAX6 gene is a gene involved in eye development early on, critical for eye development across different phyla, vertebrates and flies, for example, other phyla as well. Distalis is another example, a gene involved in developmental patterning of appendages across different phyla. And so this has caused us to reconsider or think about evolution, I think, in different ways. And just one way to illustrate this is by pointing out a quote from Ernst Mayr as recently as 1963. Ernst Mayr is probably one of the most forward-thinking evolutionary biologists of the 20th century, and he wrote, "Much that has been learned about gene physiology makes it evident that the search for homologous genes, in other words, the same genes in different groups, is quite futile except in very close relatives." So he couldn't have been more wrong. We're finding exactly the opposite of this. We're finding this highly conserved molecular machinery. And so I think this quote is evidence of how this is really reshaping how evolutionary biologists are thinking about how evolution works in a lot of fundamental ways. So just as Darwin transformed biology in the 1860s to thinking about the common descent of all species, so this is a sketch on the top left here, a sketch from Darwin's 1837 notebook, where this was probably the first time that he conceived of this idea of common descent of all organisms. So instead of thinking of organisms as independently derived by creation, for example, we started thinking and realizing that organisms were all shared a common descent. So similarly, this is a sort of similar revolution that we're experiencing now, in that it's not only the species, but it's also the genetic components and a lot of the morphological features that we can start to conceive of in the same sort of framework. The same sort of idea of common descent underlies not only species, but also other levels of biological organization. And it's this way of thinking that has led to some fundamental questions in evolutionary biology, namely, how can this tremendous diversity that we see be reconciled with common descent? How is it possible that all this shared molecular machinery can give rise to the tremendous amount of diversity that we see? And that's probably the central driving question in my research program. And what I'd like to talk about today is that part of the answer is in duplication and divergence. And so I think duplication and divergence is important at all different levels of biological organization, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. So we can sort of reconcile this idea of common descent by thinking about different facets of organisms duplicating and then diverging. So they come from a common ancestor, yet they also diverge at the same time and take on new functions. So it's perhaps one way to reconcile this idea of conservation yet diversity, which contribute to what we see in biology. And so just to make this a little more explicit, we can think about replication and divergence at the level of species, as people have since Darwin. We can imagine an ancestral species and some sort of process, occurs, such as reproductive isolation, to allow those species or cause those that ancestral population to differentiate and become multiple species. And so this gives rise to phylogenetic trees, the relationships among organisms. And I use these phylogenetic trees a lot in my research to try and understand evolutionary history. So the idea is that this is a process of speciation causing these branching patterns, and we can actually reconstruct these branching patterns by comparing data from different species. Just real quickly, how do we do that? Basically, we consider all the possible different evolutionary relationships among a set of taxa. So here I've picked some primates. So this is the oldest joke in phylogenetic biology, to put Bush against a chimp, making the same pose, but it's always funny anyways. But so if we have four taxa, here shown as a human, a chimp, an orangutan, and a gorilla, there's three different possible phylogenetic relationships between those. And basically, we consider each of those three different possibilities, and we look at some data, for example, DNA sequence data, and count the number of differences or similarities between the two, and figure out which of these different evolutionary trees is most consistent with the data that we have. So, I mean, I spend almost a whole course on it. I could spend a whole course on this, so this is just one slide in case you haven't thought about that before. But the reason that I'm interested in phylogeny is that it informs us about evolution. So we can have a phylogenetic tree of species, and that can inform hypotheses about how traits of those species has evolved. So for example, we can imagine just some phylogenetic tree that we have estimated based on some independent set of data, DNA sequence data, for example. And we can imagine having two different states of a particular trait, such as eyes being present or eyes being absent. And we can plot that in the living species that we see, for example, represented by the squares at the top. And then we can begin to make hypotheses and test hypotheses about how those traits must have evolved to give rise to the distribution that we see in these species. And so if people misunderstand one thing when I talk, it's to forget that we have two different sets of data here, basically. We have the phylogenetic tree, which is one set of data, and we have the traits that we're interested in. So I just always want to make sure to clearly point that out, that these are two separate things. We have a phylogenetic tree, for example, estimated from DNA data, and then we are interested in mapping a particular trait as to how it fits onto this phylogenetic tree. And so one thing that we can do then is we can reconstruct evolutionary history, or estimate how we think evolutionary history might have proceeded. A simple way of doing this is by parsimony, basically choosing the least number of evolutionary changes that have had to occur to give rise to the distribution of traits that we see. And so, for example, what we're doing is just thinking of all the different possible ways that this distribution of states at the top, the yellow versus white, could have evolved. So we could imagine the one in the top left, where the trait was gained two different times, one in the ancestor of the two at the top right, and one gain along this branch here. We can also imagine other evolutionary scenarios. For example, this trait, the eye, for example, could have been present in the ancestor here and then lost multiple different times. And so parsimony just favors the particular scenario that requires the fewest number of changes on this tree. And so based on parsimony, then we would favor number one, scenario number one, requiring only two gains of a trait versus scenario number two, five losses of a trait.
So you're assuming the tree is already given a fixed
amount. Yes. Right, exactly. So we are assuming that the tree is known based on some other information like DNA sequence data. Well, sort of. There's methods for getting around that I won't go into, but But for all practical purposes, we do assume that we know the tree. Yeah. There's other methods besides parsimony. We can create a model of character evolution. And I'll talk more about how this model works later on in detail in the context of some more specific work. But just to give you an idea of what these pies mean, basically we can have a model of a maximum likelihood model. It's a Markov model for how this trait evolves from one branch point to another. And then we can estimate the likelihood that a particular ancestral node was either absent or present. And so what this pi then represents is if we fix this node to be absent, what is the likelihood of observing the data at the tips of the tree versus if we fix this node to be in the present state, then what is the likelihood of observing the tips of the tree based on the phylogeny that we have. And then often we show this in the pie diagram where the likelihood of one state is shown in proportion to the likelihood of another state. So in this case, the likelihood of it being absent is much higher than the likelihood of it being present. Since we're using maximum likelihood statistics in this case, then we can use real statistical tests.
So the pi is the output of the analysis.
That's right, yeah, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yes, yep, yeah. The pi is based on two sort of separate analyses of fixing it two different ways. It's just a way of showing the relative likelihood of each of these different possible states. Yep. On the what? Conditional probabilities of there is a specific model that is used, and I'll go into that a little bit later, but well, we never know. So actually the parameters of the model are estimated from the data as well, but yeah, that's important. Distribution. Well, this is observed data, and basically we're saying, okay, we're assuming this tree, and we have a probability model, and basically you can think of it as like, evolving, starting from this state, then what is the chance of, yeah.
From that, that's where you're getting.
Yes, yeah, from doing that two different times. Yes, they're fully general in that it's only the number of states that we score. So it's either, so in this case there's only present or absent. So then we just have a two-state Markov model where there's the rate of gain or and the rate of loss are the only two parameters. And so it doesn't matter what the particular states are. It's just gain or loss. So in that sense, they're perfectly general, but that's a problem in that, you know, they may not apply equally well to any different character that we might choose. Yes, and we never know what those are, except that we estimate them from the data. Yeah. I mean, in theory, that those sorts of things could be put into the model. So if these were eyes, for example, if these species lived in the dark, then we would expect it losses to be more common than gain. In practice, we never have enough data to really do that. But yeah, so this very simple model is as far as we've gotten, basically. So just another thing that I'll point out before I get into the research that I'm actually working on is that these processes, these splitting processes, these phylogenetic trees happen at different levels of organization. And so I pointed out before the species tree, but within those species then, there are genes that are also evolving and in somewhat correlation with the species, but also somewhat independently. And I'll talk about more what I mean about that. And so we can imagine, as I pointed out before, that we can have this speciation event that splits these two different populations into two different species. And we could have then what's called an orthologous duplication. So what this means is that the particular gene that is present in the ancestral species then is maintained in both the descendant species. And so since now this is two different species, we think of these then as two different genes. And so we can trace this back to a duplication of the species event. So this gene then was duplicated in this speciation event. It was caused by this higher level duplication. We can also have paralogous duplications, and that is when genes duplicate within particular lineage, within a particular species. And so the idea here then is that the gene tree isn't always congruent with the species tree. Different things can happen at these different levels of organization. And so this is one of the things that I've become interested in, not at comparing these patterns of duplication across multiple different levels of biological organization. And that's one of the main themes that I'll talk about today. And of course, in addition to orthologous and paralogous duplications, genes within a species can be lost sometimes. And so this is another case of how these gene trees and species trees don't necessarily have to be congruent.
So, do I understand, I'm sorry, I just learned this
mm-hmm.
now.
Yep.
Orthologous,
yeah.
Right. In that kind of thing, the CGHD sequence is the same, right? But the second kind of CGHD sequence would become different?
Well, no. Well, at the time of duplication, in both cases, they're the same. And then you will have some process, some mutations that occur along these independent lineages that will cause them to differentiate.
But it's the same.
Right. But that's the same for a paralogous. So when the duplication happens, they still will be the same within the same lineage, with the same species lineage. And then along those blue branches, the split blue branches, then they will begin to differentiate. And so what I've been thinking about a lot lately is that these replicative processes can happen at all different levels of biological organization. So as I've already mentioned, populations can diverge by reproductive isolation, cause speciation events. Genes can duplicate by gene duplication. Domains, individual units of proteins can also duplicate themselves and rearrange and form new proteins. Entire chromosomes can duplicate. Entire genomes can duplicate. Cell types can also duplicate and differentiate. And also organs, such as eyes, which I'll talk about today, can also duplicate and by processes which I'm calling fission, basically. And so not too many people have thought about this at all these different levels of organization. And I think a lot of it's dating back to that quote that I put up by Ernst Mayr. People don't think about this deep history of all these different levels of biological organization. Traditionally, people have thought about selection, natural selection, as reorganizing or erasing history very rapidly. But we're finding, as I said, that these deep histories are common across even animal phyla and beyond. Horizontal gene transfer? It's basically, you can think of it as sort of a gene duplication, but it's a different sort of thing in that it's going across different species lineages. It's relevant, and I'm thinking about it, but it's not specifically included on this list. It is, yeah. It's a little different because it's actually jumping across. So it would be like taking that lineage at the top and moving it down to here. So I'm not talking about that today, but I do think about it.
I'm glad you asked that question, because I was wondering the same thing, that when you have trees, you always consider trees in the leaf. Is this related question?
Yeah, I think it is in a way, but I would say that even in horizontal gene transfer, there is a tree, because if you break it down enough, so at the level of the gene, there is a tree that's a bifurcating tree, but at the level of the species, then it becomes more complicated because it's rejoining. It's a hybridization. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so one thing that I've been thinking about then that not many other people are thinking about is the idea of actually constructing phylogenetic histories for other things besides just species and genes, but things in between, for example, such as structures. So I've pointed out that eyes also undergo these replicative processes, the entire structure of the eye. And just like we think of a gene evolving within species, we can think of these structures as evolving within species. So we can imagine an ancestral species having something like an eye. We can imagine the same kinds of process like an orthologous duplication that if the eye, after a speciation event, is present in these two descendant lineages, that then this eye can be considered an orthologous duplication. It was duplicated in the speciation event and was maintained in the descendants. We can also have paralogous duplications where the eye itself is duplicated within a lineage. And there's lots of examples of organisms with multiple eyes, which means that they must have had some sort of paralogous duplication event during evolutionary history. Yeah. Well, I think that's sort of an open question, but in general, the genes for a process are not localized, although there's some recent evidence showing that there is more, they're more localized by function than we might have expected. So, you know, 15 years ago, we would say that it's completely random with respect to where they are in the genome, but I've seen some papers based on microarray expression data that, based on function, there's some localization on chromosomes. But yeah. Oh. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's what I want to know. Are there correlations between duplications of eyes and duplications of genes? How often does that happen? And so that's what I'm starting to explore now, and I'll talk about that actually today. And so again, just like with genes, we can lose an eye during evolution, and again, this could cause this incongruence between the histories at one level versus another level. So basically, that leads to the central questions of my research program. And I just said some of these. Do similar patterns occur at different levels of biological organization? When we see a duplication in an eye, does that automatically mean that there were all the genes involved in making those eyes were duplicated? How do duplicative changes at one level affect other levels? What is the level of causation? Is it always the genes that have to come first, or could higher level structures sort of be duplicated first and then put pressure on the genes to duplicate? Or perhaps the genes don't always have to duplicate. Perhaps they're just utilized in different ways. And then also, what this really boils down to is what are the mechanisms responsible for origins of evolutionary novelty? So how is it that we see these new structures evolve during evolution? And that's what I'm trying to understand better. So, what I had planned to do was to talk about three different levels of organization. First of all, at the gene level. Second of all, at the level of cell types, talking about vertebrate rod and cone cells of the eye, the retina. And then also talk about at the level of organs, at the level of eyes themselves, and some work that I'm doing in my lab on ostracoid crustacean eyes. I'm not sure if there'll be time to go through all of it, but we'll see how far we get. First of all, thinking about at the level of the gene, and we can think of the central question here is, do similar evolutionary patterns occur at different levels of biological organization? And basically, there's a pattern that we've known about for a long time that occurs at the level of structures, of duplicated structures in organisms. And I'm curious as to whether that holds at the level of genes and of gene expression. And so basically the hypothesis is that loss or repression of gene expression, so we is more common during evolution than gain of gene expression. So basically, during evolution, genes that were turned on in some places during the organism are more commonly turned off than turned on at new places. So that's the hypothesis. And so the pattern that I mentioned of this idea of repeated elements being lost more commonly than gain has been pointed out by evolutionary biologists for close to 100 years. So one idea is the idea of tagmosis. This is mostly talked about in arthropods, where the idea is that the ancestral species had duplicated structures, such as on the top there, that were similar to each other. And then over the course of evolution, these duplicated structures became specialized and also reduced in number. And so one good example is that this case in insects, where the idea is that the number of legs was not only reduced, but also the individual legs were specialized during evolution. Other ideas, similar ideas, are the idea of oligomerization, so the idea that parasites that have duplicated structures more often lose these duplicated structures than gain them. And Williston's law was basically the same idea of loss and specialization, only Williston proposed it for vertebrates. And propose that, for example, the individual vertebrae of vertebrates over evolutionary time have become reduced in number and specialized. Teeth are another thing. They may start out to be all the same, but then over evolutionary time they specialize and reduce in number.
You're not saying that the total number of
genes? No. Well, no, not the total number of active genes, but the number of places where a particular gene is turned on is decreasing. And so that's what we're testing. Yeah. During evolutionary time. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You mean if you have... I don't understand the question. Comparing what and what is apples and oranges? The genes.
I know how many genes I have.
Yeah.
And you can define the probability of losing a gene per generation.
Right.
I'll
go through it. Yeah, I'm going to go through in detail how we calculate this. So ask me again if it's not clear in about six slides. Exactly. We're actually gaining genes. We have to gain genes by duplication in order to be able to lose places where they're expressed, where they're turned on. So we're losing. So to maintain an equilibrium, we have to have duplication. Yes. Right. So at the morphological level, there may be some association at the level of gene regulation. And this was pointed out by Sean Carroll in a book recently. And he wrote, the diversification of repeated parts often entails a selective repression of developmental regulatory networks in some of those parts. And so in insects, we know that what's happening is that there's actually a repression of the program for turning on legs in the abdomen here. And so what's going on is that you can imagine that the ancestral arthropod had the program for making legs in all the different segments, and then it was turned off at some of these different segments. It doesn't mean that the whole program was lost, but it was lost in these different segments. And so... Yeah. This is a hypothesis that I am testing.
You're testing.
Yes.
There's no theory to understand.
Well, what do you mean by theory? You mean a mechanism, or? Well, this is, yes, perhaps by, if it allows for specialization, that could be an advantage, or, you know, evolution doesn't have to always proceed by having an advantage, especially over these long-term, long time scales. That's what, yes, that's what I will, yeah, yeah. Well, but some of the functions are lost. So, yeah, some of the functions, but not all of them are lost. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Switched off some, in some parts. And so I just like how Sean Carroll wrote this, and would like to read this, how he wrote why this hypothesis is important. And so he said, if gene repression is easier to evolve than activation, then the morphological diversity that follows from the selective repression of gene expression may be one of the most important evolutionary correlates of the logic of cis-regulatory element function. So he sees this as an important generality, potential generality for how genes are turned on and off. But this hypothesis has not been tested. And so a graduate student in my lab, Bjorn Ostman, and I tested this idea. So then the idea then is exactly that. During the evolution of duplicate genes, is the loss of gene expression domains faster than the gain of gene expression domains? And there is one, so basically what I've told you about are just patterns that people have noticed, but there's also a particular process that could account for this idea that loss of domains during evolution is faster than gain. And this is the idea of a model called DDC, or duplication, degeneration, and complementation. And so this is an idea that we have a particular gene which has a coding region, and then we can imagine these two shapes, this circle and this triangle, as being regulatory elements. You can think of these just as switches, and this switch turns this gene on in one place, and this gene, this regulatory element turns this gene on in another place. And so these are modular regulatory elements. You can think of these as turning on this gene, this coding gene in the brain and in the eye, or something like that. And so then the idea is that there's a gene duplication event that duplicates this entire portion of the gene, both the regulatory elements and the gene itself. And this is common during evolution. So then we have both of these duplicated genes, which at the initial time of duplication are very similar to each other, expressed in both different places. And so this DDC model then argues that a likely outcome is for there to be mutations, in separate mutations, in complementary regulatory elements. And so if this happens then, knock out the triangle on one gene, knock out the circle on the other gene, then even though these genes basically haven't differentiated yet in function, in coding function, they become necessary for the organism to function, because only when both of these together are present, both of these genes remain present, then they complement each other to form the ancestral function. And so this was a problem in the idea of gene duplication, because the theory, population genetic theory, predicts that genes should be lost very rapidly during evolution after duplication. But that wasn't seen. And so this became one mechanism by which duplicate genes could be maintained, because through simple mutations in the regulatory elements, both of the duplicates become necessary in order to complement the original function, or to maintain the original function. And so this is one scenario whereby the loss of individual expression domains should be faster during evolution than gain. And so that's a specific mechanism to account for the pattern that people have observed, potentially at the morphological level, and people have suggested at the gene level. And so the triangle and the circle are switches that drive the turning on this particular gene in different places in the animal. No, it's just arbitrary notation. Yeah, it's just two different regulatory elements. It doesn't mean anything specific. No, there's other possibilities as well, but those would tend to be lost during evolution, for example. The entire gene would disappear then. For example, if you knocked out both regulatory elements, then the gene wouldn't be used anymore. And so based on, they worked out the population genetics, this, you know, depending on the population size of the species and different parameters, under a lot of different conditions, this scenario becomes the most probable outcome. This complementary. Right, yeah. Well, actually, they could. And that's one important idea. So if this gene had two different functions, you know, one function in the brain and one function in the eye or something, perhaps there's a trade-off. It can't specialize in either one. Once it duplicates, it can become optimal for these different, you know, different functions potentially. Well, no, this ancestral gene is expressed in two different places, so potentially there's a trade-off because there's different demands in those two different places. After the duplication, it can specialize for each of those different functions. And so, again, we have two different types of data to test this hypothesis, and I'll talk more specifically about the data, but we have phylogenies, the phylogenies of fly gene families, and we have gene expression data from these genes in flies. And so again, just like early on when I pointed out, you know, we have the phylogeny and we have a trait that's being mapped. What I'm doing here is mapping this trait of gene expression onto gene family phylogenies. And then we can estimate these rates of gain of expression domains and loss of expression domains using maximum likelihood. And so the data come from the Berkeley Drosophila Genome Project. We've downloaded data from this particular embryonic stage. They've done these in situ hybridization experiments, which is basically mapping where the genes are turned on by this blue color. They've had one individual go in and annotate where these different genes are expressed. And so it's basically a list of all the places where these different genes are expressed. And they've done thousands of different genes. And so what we can think of then is each of these columns then as being a different gene expression domain, eye, brain, each different column is a different particular expression domain that was scored by the annotator. Again, we have the phylogeny of the genes themselves based on the DNA sequence. And we have the expression patterns as traits of these individual genes. And so the question is then, during evolution, were new expression domains turned on more often than they were turned off, or vice versa? And so I usually put this up, even though we didn't actually use parsimony, a lot of times parsimony is easier for people to intuitively understand. And so this is just a one way of thinking about what we're doing. We have different gene families. These two different trees represent two different gene families. We have the phylogeny of these different genes. Each row up there then represents, each row of numerals up here represents a different expression pattern. And in this gene family, we can imagine that there were two gains in expression based on just the parsimony, minimizing the number of changes that have happened to had to have occurred to give the pattern of data that we see. This is another gene family then, and this we can infer by parsimony as there being three losses of gene expression domains during evolution based on the pattern that we see. So again, each row is a different gene expression domain, whether it's on or off in each of these different genes. So basically what we're doing is we're comparing all of the different gene families for which we have data and counting the number of losses and the number of gains. But really, we're not just counting these with parsimony. We're using maximum likelihood in order to estimate these rate parameters of gain versus loss. And so this is just the total number of data. So it's not just these two gene families, but it's 28 gene families of size 3 to 7 genes per family. And then it's not just these three expression domains. We really have 115 different expression domains. Yep. An expression domain is a particular place where a gene is turned on. So it could be a place in an organism where a gene is turned on. A tissue type, yeah, for example, or cell type. It could be multiple different sizes. Yeah. Each of the rows, each row is a different expression domain. Yeah. Potentially. Yeah, every gene is scored for every expression domain. Yeah. And so to estimate the rates then, we're using a two-state Markov model, as I alluded to a little bit before, and just counting one as being expressed in a particular domain and zero as being not expressed in a particular domain. And we have then two rate parameters, either there's a gain or there's a loss. There's a rate of gain and a rate of loss are the two different parameters. And we estimate these rates of alpha and beta, rate of gain, rate of loss, by maximum likelihood. And this shows basically how we do this, at least in a small part of how we calculate this whole formula. So this is just showing for one particular phylogeny, gene family phylogeny, and then this is a partial likelihood function for just one node of this phylogeny. And so basically, A is that ancestral node there, so we have the probability of going from whatever the state was, either 0 or 1 in node A, to what we observe as being a 0 in this tree here. And given our parameters that we're trying to estimate, alpha and beta, and then this number is the branch length, it's the amount of time that we assume is available for change, and that's based on the number of nucleotide changes, times the probability of starting in A and ending at 1 along that longer branch. And so again, there's the branch length there. And here again, this is dependent on what we estimate for these parameters. And so basically, we maximize this function in order to estimate alpha and beta, the rates of gain and the rates of loss. And as I said, this is just one node out of two different nodes on this tree. And then also we have 50 different gene families, so it's also the product over all those gene families. And so we're estimating these parameters, alpha and beta, over all this data at the same time. So we're hypothesizing that loss is faster than gain. And so this box then will show the likelihood function. So along this axis is the a parameter, the rate of gain parameter. Along this axis is the loss parameter. And so different points in this box then will represent different combinations of the rates of gain and loss. So the highest, the point in this graph with the highest likelihood will be what we infer as the maximum likelihood estimate of the rates of gain and loss. So we would expect that if loss is faster than gain, that the likelihood would be higher on this side of the chart than on the other side. And that's exactly what we find. Notice these are log likelihood values, so that's a huge difference in the likelihood on one side versus the other side. And there is a maximum on this, which we take, we have estimated the maximum of the loss parameter to be 341 and the gain parameter to be 147. Those numbers don't mean anything in and of themselves. They're just relative to the branch lengths that we have scaled. But that is a maximum, but that maximum, even though if we change that ratio, statistically it's much worse, but if we stay along the same ratio and change where we are along this line, given that ratio, we can't distinguish. So basically we can't say we have a specific maximum, but we can say that we have a maximum that lies somewhere along this line, and that line is a ratio of gain to loss of about 0.47, so loss is about twice as fast as gain given the data that we have included here. And so that supports this hypothesis that at the level of gene expression, loss of domains is faster than gain during evolution. And so to conclude for this section, and probably I won't go any further, we can say that we can use phylogenetic methods to study the evolution of gene expression. And so in the field of evolution of development, the evolution of gene expression is an important, perhaps the most fundamental type of data that people are trying to evaluate, but no one's done it in a quantitative context using these phylogenetic models. And one reason, perhaps, is that it's very complicated, the regulatory mechanisms involved in turning genes on and off in different places. And so basically we're avoiding all those mechanisms, all those complicated mechanisms, and just looking at the pattern that results and utilizing that pattern as the data that we're trying to evaluate. And so so this is not quite true. It doesn't require information about regulatory mechanisms, I say, but after we really got into this, we realized that if we had more information about regulatory mechanisms, we could have educated our model a little better. So I think it's complementary to knowledge about regulatory mechanisms themselves. We found this result that repression is faster than activation at least for these gene families, recently duplicated gene families within Drosophila. And then this raises the question whether these similar patterns at different levels, whether this pattern of loss of duplicated elements, duplicated morphological elements, is really due to this pattern that we see at the level of genes. And so people like Sean Carroll have suggested this, that it perhaps is actually causative. He suggested this based on numerous different case studies, but no one's tested the generality of this at the gene level, and so that's the first time this has been done. But it's still, there isn't a direct link here between genes and phenotypes. And that's really what I'm striving for. And that's what the rest of this talk was about. Some of my other work on phenotypes, such as eyes within ostracod crustaceans that I study, and whether or not these same sorts of correlations exist of duplications at one level compared to duplications at another level. But I spent about 50 minutes. I don't know, I could tell you a little bit about the biology of ostracods, but maybe I'll stop here and take any additional questions. How many? 15? Okay, yeah, if anybody needs to leave, I won't mind. So I'll skip part two, which is vertebrate rods and cones, so that's linking cell types with these duplicative processes. And I'll go to this idea of organs, actually, the eyes themselves duplicating and diverging during evolution. I actually took this part A out, and I'll talk about this idea of the origin of compound eyes in ostracods. And so the idea is that there's been an independent origin of compound eyes in ostracod crustaceans. And I'll talk about the evidence for that. And the question is, where did these come from? Where did these eyes come from? Were there gene duplications involved in, or even duplications of entire structures involved in the origin of these eyes? And so I'll just give you a quick introduction to ostracods, since most people aren't familiar with them. They're small bivalve crustaceans. Their ancient group, they're at least 510 million year old lineage. We have fossils that are 510 million years old. There's 40,000 described species, and only about 8,000 of those are living, so that means about 32,000 are actually only fossil species. So there's a really good stratigraphic record, a good fossil record. This is mostly their carapaces, so I'll show some pictures of these, but they're inside these bivalve carapaces, and these are made of calcium, and so these fossilize very easily. The phylogeny and taxonomy is poorly understood, so I have plenty to keep me busy. There's estimated 16,000 undescribed species. I dipped a bucket in the water in next to a marine lab in Puerto Rico and found a new species by accident, literally. This is what the living organism looks like. This is a particular species from Japan called Vargula hilgendorfii. It's about 2 millimeters long. These are scavengers, and they swim at sunset and scavenge dead fish, for example. They use their second antennae to swim. So all crustaceans have two pairs of antennae, and you can see it sticking out its second pair of antennae and sort of using them like oars to swim in the water. But probably what they spend most of their time doing is burrowing into the sand when they're not feeding at sunset. And so presumably it's safer down there. The females, this is a female, actually brood the young. They keep the young inside the carapace back here. And they use this organ, which is called a worm-like organ, an appendage that sticks back there. And they will actually manipulate their offspring while they're brooding them, presumably to allow them to get more oxygen. So you can see that that's what this female is doing here. She's brooding her young, and her worm-like organ, her seventh limb up at the top, is moving the young around. It's actually, the black dot is the compound eye. Yeah, so this one is about 2 millimeters from front to back. So there's a lot of evolutionary novelties associated with eyes and vision in ostracods, and I'm studying a number of these. And one that we're studying in the lab is this extreme sexual dimorphism of the eyes. So the male has these large compound eyes, among the largest of any ostracod, but the female has no eyes at all. And so we're interested in what the genetic basis of that is, how that's possible. So it means that we know that the female must have the genes for making those eyes, but they're not being employed. There's also a family, large family of bioluminescent ostracods that use these courtship displays. And the males signal to the females above stereotyped microhabitats. So males of different species will have different signals. So just like fireflies east of the Rockies, if you grew up east of the Rockies like I did, or somewhere else that has fireflies, you've seen these come out at night. The males signal to the females. The females then swim up and mate with the males. There's also instances of sneaker males, males that don't do the work to put out the signal, but they'll follow along a male that is signaling and sneak copulation without actually doing any of the work. This is a huge, yeah, I should always switch the order of that or something. But so basically, these are completely different groups of ostracods. So I should always say that. I always forget because people always ask me. So these are completely different groups of ostracods. So in those bioluminescent species, the females actually do have eyes. So this is just one particular family. This is another family. In another completely different group, the eyes have become these huge parabolic reflectors. So these parabolic reflectors presumably reflect the light dim amount of light from the deep sea onto retinas that are in the middle of these eyes, and these are predators. These are the largest living ostracods, and these guys prey upon fish sometimes. And one group of ostracods actually has three different eyes, these two different compound eyes, two lateral compound eyes that are the same, and a median eye. So one group has both compound eyes and this median eye, which is just a simple eye found at the middle, basically, of what you might call the head. And so this is important for what I'll talk about next, the idea that perhaps these eyes evolved independently with respect to other arthropods, and perhaps these eyes were duplicated from this eye, which has probably been present the entire time. So I'm going to argue, based on phylogenetic evidence, that this compound eye evolved independently from other arthropods. But then the question is, where did this novelty come from, and what genomic changes are involved? And were these duplicative processes that I've been talking about potentially involved? And so basically, what I'll argue is that these ostracods that have compound eyes are phylogenetically nested within multiple different groups that lack compound eyes. So it's only this one group of ostracods that has compound eyes. And so if we map this trait onto a phylogeny, so again, this is a phylogeny of these different species of ostracods based on DNA sequence data. And then we can map this trait of presence or absence of compound eyes onto this tree, as I described early on, using this maximum likelihood method. And we can compare the likelihood at these different ancestral nodes of there being an eye absent or an eye present. And at multiple of these different ancestral nodes, there's statistical support for there being absence of the compound eye. So that suggests potentially that ostracods evolved this compound eye independently of other arthropods. There is an alternative hypothesis, and that is that eyes were lost multiple times independently, and I have investigated that statistically. I'm not going to talk about that today. What I'm doing now is, in addition to just mapping this trait onto the tree, looking for other potential evidence, other genomic changes that might have happened around the same time that might be correlated with this change in the gain of the putative gain of this compound eye in ostracods. So that was the compound eye, and this then is mapping the other eye, this median eye, onto the same phylogeny. And here there's support for this eye being present in all of the ancestors of the ostracods. And we've expanded this phylogeny a lot lately in the lab, and this, both of these hold up, where it looks like, you know, there's an independent origin of the compound eye, but the median eye was present the entire time. So if we plot this in a way that that I was plotting these different kinds of traits earlier on, showing the species tree in the green here, and we can envision a phylogenetic tree of these different traits, like the median eye shown in the purple and the compound eye shown in yellow, only these within ostracods, only these myotocopids have the compound eye, yet the median eye was probably present throughout the history of ostracods. And so that plotting it this way, it made me wonder if it was possible that there was a paralogous duplication event, whether this eye, this median eye, was actually duplicated somehow, and that was responsible for the evolution of this new compound eye. And so this is basically a hypothesis that we're testing now in the lab by looking at the genes involved in these different types of eyes. And so we've started with a particular gene. That's basically what I just said here, asking whether there were gene duplications involved here, whereby some genes specialize for the compound eye and some genes specialize for the median eye, and whether we can date those gene duplications to this particular time point. And so the first gene that we started with, we needed to find a gene that had specific expression of one gene type in compound eyes and one gene type in median eyes. And I suspected that the opsin genes might show that. So opsin is the gene that directly responds to light in all metazoans. And in flies have both compound eyes and a simple ocellus at the top of the head. They each have their own, each of those fly organs has their own opsins. And so I guessed that ostracods might have the same sort of phenomenon where the compound eye expresses one kind of gene and opsin gene, and the median eye expresses a different kind of gene. And so found that to be true based on RT-PCR, just a PCR test for gene expression. And so what that means then, we've looked at two species so far, what that means is that there was a gene duplication at some point in the past, and that these different opsin genes have specialized to be used in the compound eye and to be used in the median eye. And so the question then is whether or not these gene duplications occurred at the time when we would expect, based on the phylogeny, that the compound eyes themselves evolved. And so again, so this is showing that same diagram, thinking of this phylogenetic history of the median eye shown in purple or pink here, and the phylogenetic history of the compound eye shown in yellow. And if we had these gene duplication events associated here, that would be further support for this hypothesis. And so we found then gene duplication events that may have happened around here, and what we're doing now is trying to narrow down exactly when those gene duplication events happened. We don't know that it happened exactly here. It could have happened a bit earlier, so what we need next is to find opsin genes from this outgroup, this ostracod that doesn't have compound eyes, and if it is not more closely related to one of the either compound eye specific or median eye specific. In other words, if this gene duplication happened after the split from that species, then it will support this hypothesis of a recent origin of compound eyes in ostracods. And so what I've argued then is that there's duplicative processes that are occurring at different levels of organization, and these duplicative processes may be correlated with each other. The correlations, I skipped a good example of when duplications are occurring at the gene level that are correlated with duplications that have happened at the cell type level. But I've argued that at the level of genes, that there is, we know that there's duplication and divergence that happens at the level of genes, and that gene expression, we found evidence that expression domains are more commonly lost than gained, and there's similar patterns here at the gene level, also at the level, similar patterns to levels of, at structures such as repeated segments in arthropods. And that's one thing that I've become interested in lately is can we compare across levels of organization these different duplicative processes? I didn't talk about number two, but then starting to think about a potential case of where an organ itself has actually been duplicated, and talked about the possibility that the median eye, which was present throughout ostracod evolution, was actually duplicated to form compound eyes. And I think, that's all I have. I'll leave some acknowledgments, and then if there's any further questions, I can try and answer those. So thanks. Yep. Right, it's
something that allows you to keep an evidence of subtracting prime duplication.
Yeah, exactly. It's
anything else duplicated or
not yet.
Regulation that diverged,
I mean, ideally, that's what we are trying to find. First of all, we're looking for evidence that, you know, further confirmation that this really was an independent origin. So Opsin was the first case where we're starting to look. But I think we'll also look for multiple different phototransduction genes and see if all of those were duplicated, which has actually happened in vertebrate rods and cones. All the genes that are involved in rods and cones are duplicates of each other, and they were duplicated probably at around the origin of vertebrates. So potentially something similar has happened in ostracods. And then we would also like to look at the regulatory genes. We've looked at one gene, PAX6, and found something unique there, and we're still following that up. Basically, most arthropods have, or flies at least, have two different PAX6 genes, one called Twinovilus, one called Ilus. And one is used more in the compound eye, and one is used more in the ocellus, the simple eyes in flies. But in the ostracod, they only have one of these duplicated genes, and that one gene looks to be involved in development of both the median eye and the compound eye. But that's preliminary in situ data that we have. But that's at least consistent, again, with this idea. Yeah, we have. And so this PAX6 gene is used in the development of both eye types, so that's at least consistent also with the with this duplication hypothesis. Well, morphologically, it's fairly similar. So whether or not all arthropod compound eyes have a single origin has been debated for a long time. People who think that there was a single origin will say that all these divergent kinds of arthropods have this cell pattern within each of the different facets. There's 8 retinular cells and 4 crystalline cone cells. And ostracods differ from that in having 6 retinular cells and 2 crystalline cone cells. But, you know, there is a lot of variation within those cell types that people who argue for homology don't usually talk about. But again, that's at least consistent. You know, they're different and they're unique in having the 6-2 pattern. So that's at least consistent with this idea that they're independent. So. Mammals do have a third eye, actually, but it's degenerated. So vertebrates, yeah. There's the pineal gland that still expresses opsin, and it's probably involved in circadian rhythms, detecting night and day. In other vertebrates, it's a full-blown photoreceptor, but in mammals, it has become basically a gland, so. Oh, in the back of the head? Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Evolutionary, I don't know. Well, not specifically. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities. It could be developmentally difficult. It could be not that advantageous. I don't know. Yeah, there's lots of possibilities. It could be definitely some sort of constraint that just doesn't allow it to happen. Yep. Yeah. So whether or not it's similar similar types of programs that set cell number as well as oh, I see, right. Yeah, yeah. Whether that Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't thought about that at all. It suggests to me a comparative test whether lineages that we know have fixed cell numbers show lower numbers of duplicated elements. So, you know, it's a good comparative hypothesis, basically. But I haven't thought about it. Fixed cell lineages? I don't know. Fixed cell number, yeah. I don't know, actually. Have a fixed cell numbers. Yeah. Yeah. All right, thanks.